Welcome to episode 43 of the Historic Performance Podcast. This week, you're in for a little bit of a treat. There's going to be two podcasts instead of one, simply because Andrew Weissman, whose podcast you're listening to right now, and who is the strength and conditioning coach for Celtic Football Club women's team, I wasn't sure if he was going to be able to make it on. So I also booked Michael, who is with Sri Lanka Cricket. So for today's episode, we're going to be highlighting strength and conditioning in sports science and women's football. It's an area that I've wanted to highlight for a while. I did so way back at the beginning of the podcast in episode 2 with Joshua Neff, who is with the Chicago Red Stars, which is a professional team here in the United States. Unfortunately, I tried to get others involved in women's football to come on the podcast, but all of them declined. So I'm really grateful for Andrew coming on the podcast and taking the time to explain the work that he does over at Celtic. In today's episode, Andrew talks about postural and dynamic assessments, the LESS test that he does, energy system development, and a typical weekly microcycle at Celtic. Let's get started. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Historic Performance Podcast. I'd like to extend a warm welcome to Andrew Weissman. Really happy to have him on today on a Monday evening in England. Andrew, how are you?
I'm great, James. Thank you.
Andrew, to start us off, could you tell us a little bit about your physical preparation journey and how you ended up at Celtic Football Club?
Yeah, sure. First of all, thanks for having me on, James. I'm absolutely privileged to have been asked. Looking at some of the names you've had on before me, it's an absolute honour. I suppose I didn't really have the sort of traditional academic route into strength and conditioning in football. I started off as a player, both here and in Ireland. I had quite a few clubs as a youngster, but quite a few injury problems, really, to be honest, which effectively ended my career. It kind of got me thinking a little bit into the sort of the why these injuries occurred rather than how. I worked as a technical coach, doing some of my coaching badges originally in England, working with players from 18 to 8. I was lucky enough to work with both Chelsea and West Ham in their community schemes many years ago. I also ran my own academy in Dublin, which was pretty good. And I was also the under-18s coach with Shamrock Rovers, again over in Dublin. So having both been a player and a coach on the technical side, it kind of gave me an insight into sort of what players would expect from a, you know, sports science team or their S&C coach, especially from a communication perspective. But going back to when I was playing, really sports science and strength and conditioning was quite a new area. During my time in Ireland, I started an undergrad degree at Manchester Met University in conjunction with the PFA, the Professional Footballers Association. But I put this on hold for a little bit while I was running my academy in Dublin. So I moved back to the UK in 2010. And decided to take up playing again, which unfortunately led to another serious injury in 2011 and left me with a fully plated and screwed fibula, which again sort of reignited my interest in injury rehabilitation and prevention and sports science. My rehab itself probably wasn't the best, to be honest. And I think that was more out of frustration from me rather than the actual people carrying out the rehab. So I decided to get into a gym and start throwing a few weights about, really know what I was doing too much. And that led me sort of looking into like strength and conditioning and sort of the injury rehab side of things. I went back to Manchester Met and re-enrolled in my degree. They were very good in taking me back. And then I enrolled in a strength and conditioning course. And when I was on that course, I was really lucky to meet Lawrence Bloom, who was at that time the head of sports science at Charlton Athletic in London. And he invited me down to a training session with Charlton Athletic, which I really enjoyed. Chris Powell was the first team manager there. And I ended up sort of shadowing Bloom in his sports science team for the season. Which was an invaluable experience considering the changes at the club that went on during that season. And from there, I started on my UK SCA accreditation path. The season after that, I joined Stevenage, a club that I'd actually played for as a youngster, and I started working with their academy, which was another good experience. So from the first team level down to the academy, I worked mainly with the under-18s, and five of the team I worked with went on to get professional contracts. So that was pretty rewarding. But I also worked with the other age groups as well in the academy at Stevenage. You know, it was quite hands-on. I worked with anything down to the under-9s, the 16s, and all the other age groups there, which was a real eye-opener. At the start of this season, back in June, I joined Welwyn Garden City, who were a step 5 non-league team, just to keep ticking over, really. You know, jobs are few and far between in football and in SSC. So at that time, we were the first ever team at that level and the non-league level to use the Playertic GPS system, which was brilliant for our players, you know, getting a little bit more insight probably into more of what we do. And it was also great working with part-time players who they all had jobs, and it was a real insight into things like load management at a part-time level and getting those players into peak condition, taking their you know, into context all the other things going on in their life at the time, and also playing football. At round about this time, I kind of heard of the job at Celtic, a club I supported all my life. I went up in October 2015 and met David Haley, the women's first team manager and also the academy manager, and I met him up at Celtic Park. And David outlined to me sort of, you know, what his vision was for the women's first team and the academy. And to be honest, the role was sold to me immediately. David offered it to me straight away, and I don't think I even thought about it. I said yes there and then. I think my dad said to me, "What are you going to do?" I was like, "I've already said yes." So there wasn't really too much anyone could do. So that was the role I was offered with the women's section at Celtic. It's my first role in women's football, and being a lifelong, you know, Celtic fan, it's a dream come true, to be honest. It's pretty unique because the girls at Celtic are not full-time players, which is, you know, that's kind of had an influence on our programming and in a broad sense to speak. And but it's a long-term project, you know, that we've got at Celtic, and David's very clear in his vision with all of this stuff where we want to go. And you know, we've spoken in great depth recently on a convention with our international coaches on where we feel we can take or David and his staff can take the women's section. So it's really great to be involved in such a project and build it with a club, you know, as big as Celtic.
Since you mentioned that the women's aren't there full time, how often do you get to see them? And what are some of your responsibilities being a strength and conditioning coach with Celtic FC women's team?
Yeah, so I mean, our players will train four times a week, four evenings a week, which is around about 90 minutes. Our players come from quite considerable distances across Scotland. You know, we've got some coming from Edinburgh, some from down by the borders, some from further afield, actually. So it's quite vast. You know, but we do spend four nights a week training and also a game on a Sunday. So my role is predominantly working with the first team players and ensuring, you know, that they're physically prepared for games, implementing their resistance programs, the load management side of things, and energy system development. But I work closely with Alistair Taylor, who's our sports scientist. Alistair's brilliant. You know, so we then feedback that information to the coaching staff. Alistair tends to look after a little bit more of the conditioning on the pitch, and I'll look after the gym-based programs with the players who might be working through their rehab, some coming back from some are long-term injury, and some are coming back from, you know, minor little niggles that they've picked up. So I also work very closely with the physio, Justine, and we can determine the stages of rehab for any injured players, and, you know, and also look at when we can get them ready for performance, so a return to performance. You know, we're quite a multidisciplinary team. We've got an excellent relationship with David and his technical staff, Fiona Dainty and Johnny McFarlane, and everyone from the sports science and sports medicine staff. We all get on very, very well, and we all realise that we have a role to play. It's part of my role to sort of analyse the data that Alistair collects. For example, individual player load, and determine, you know, which players we might need to adjust their training load. You know, we've got quite a few international players at Celtic, so that means that, you know, we're sent testing data from the Scottish FA when they had them. And we've also got performance, National Performance Center players. So when they do their testing, we get access to that data when they're away with them. And then from that, we can determine sort of what our players' needs are. Again, you know, some players are traveling quite a considerable distance. So we have to look at that and look at those players individually. When I started there before the beginning of pre-season in January, sort of identified some key areas that we needed to develop and, look at in great depth. One of those was injury prevention and reduction. So that's also a big part of my role. I think it's pretty difficult to prevent injury as such, but we needed to look at the risk factors and identify how to minimise these for our players. So for example, through our research, we know that the most common injuries were ankle sprains or hamstring and groin injuries in women's football specifically. And of course, the quite well documented high incidence of ACL injuries in female football. So this then led us to look at sort of what the modifiable areas we could impact the most, really. We need to get the biggest bang for buck with the quite limited time that we've got for our players. So, if we're looking at the groin area, is it, hip internal rotation or the hamstring? Is it hamstring strength? And I really work with these players on what was required. We've got a philosophy within the club and within the women's section, that every player is a individual project, and that's very much how we view things. So we want the very best for the players performance wise. But we all know that as a team, everyone is critical in contributing to this and to helping the players perform at their best. Also part of my role, we sort of identified areas such as nutrition and recovery as key areas where we could really make a big impact. Myself and David have spoken quite a lot about making, the smallest changes that can make the biggest impact for our players. So, for example, we looked at pre-match nutrition. What's the player consuming? Are they aware of the impacts on performance? Intra-match nutrition, getting players to get into good habits at sort of half time, whether that be energy gels or sort of like fruit, whatever that might take. And also the post-match nutrition, so recovery shakes and the importance of refueling and getting something into their system after playing. Which is something that they may not have been exposed to before. Also, recovery sessions, we had a look at those and how we can improve those for the girls as well. So we've introduced quite a few nutritional and recovery protocols for the players, which we said, which we think is a very important area, especially for part-time players who may have to consider, who may have to travel for an hour and a half straight after training, so or a game. So we need to get them, ready and refreshed for to come into us again. But the players themselves have been brilliant working with us. And I think it's also part of my role to educate the players on, why we do what we do. And it's something we have put a massive emphasis on, giving the players accountability to make their own choices and be responsible for how they fuel themselves. But we've also used presentations and we've got a weekly email group. And it can help us give the players an insight into what we're doing and why we're doing it. And I think it's important to have that transparency with the players about what we're doing with them, because it helps to create a culture, but it also encourages players that, that they want to learn more, which is great. It's fantastic. It gives us that sort of positive environment as well, and gives them the clarity in what we do, not only from a sports science department, but also helps them to become more accountable. So again, full credit to the players, because they've been brilliant this season, really embracing the changes that we've made.
As you mentioned, your career was plagued with injuries, and that was really a catalyst for you to learn more about sports science and hopefully minimize injuries for players that you were teaching at the academy and now, of course, with Celtic FC women's team. We were chatting a little bit beforehand, and one of the things that you mentioned to me was that a good assessment includes both a static postural assessment and a dynamic assessment. So what does the assessment process look like with the ladies at Celtic?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good one. A good question, actually. It's one of those ones I think most like strength and conditioning coaches, sports scientists can be a little bit different in their selection of assessments. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, although I do feel it needs to be relevant to the population you're working with. So for us, we knew that we really needed to look at the sort of high incidence of for example, an ACL in women's football and look not only for the sort of most valid and reliable protocols, but also the most time efficient in a team environment. Again, you know, they are part-time, so we had to get the biggest bang for buck. So that kind of influenced our choice of assessments, especially where movement is concerned. So, for example, the landing error scoring system test, that gives us a look at the sort of motor control and the kinematics of, you know, football relevant tasks really, and we can then quantify the amount of sort of hip and knee extension and knee valgus, which can be major factors in ACL injuries. So I think we had to be realistic with the limited time that we had with the players. Again, as I said, you know, we're not full time, so we've got to make maximum impact with what we have, rather than trying to reinvent the wheel, to be honest. After we looked at the sort of landing error scores results, the players are then graded on their results, and this is fed back to the coaching staff. So we test this regularly to look for improvements and what further interventions sort of we can make with the players to improve them. Again, that kind of goes back to our philosophy that every player is an individual project. And for us, we really want to give them the best tools in their toolbox to really fulfill their athletic potential as elite level players that they are. We also look at an overhead squat test, look at lumbar spine control and movement dysfunction, which might cause any concern to us. Players are then profiled according to their scores. And again, this is fed back to the coaching staff, and their programs are then looked at and individualized depending on sort of our findings. So most of our players tend to have different needs. For example, we've one or two players that are under 18 in our squad who've got different needs to some of our senior internationals. So the data that we've collected throughout these assessments has helped us to build profiles of the players, which, you know, we look at areas such as their testing scores, their energy system development, and any sort of unilateral limb deficiencies. We look at that, and those players are then profiled, which we're building up over a season.
When it comes to the landing error scoring test, are there specific items or major observations that you're looking for when you're scoring it in order to create a profile for the athlete?
Yeah, I mean, we use the modified landing error score test, which has got 10 checkpoints, so 5 in the frontal plane, 5 in the sagittal plane. The test is graded out of 15 marks, and we take the mean from the 3 landing scores for each player, and that allows us to grade each player according to our findings, pretty much an injury risk index of our own. We take the camera footage in both planes and then analyze the footage later on, which allows us to get through a squad a little bit quicker with reasonable ease and without any really excessive time consumption, which can always be an issue with large squads, especially part-time squads. The players will each do 3 landings, and these are all recorded. I think in my experience, I found this a better way to try to score the player with a naked eye, because we can slow that footage down on each landing and look at the checkpoints in more detail. Once we sit down and analyze the footage, we look for the key points in each jump. So for an example, in the first jump, we're looking from the front, and we would look at the stance width. Is it normal, wide, narrow, and score an error if the stance is wider or narrower than normal? And again, in the first jump, then we'll be looking at the maximum foot rotation position. Are they internally or externally rotated on landing? If either is yes, it scores an error. We'll look at foot symmetry in the landing. Again, are they landing symmetrically, or do the players prefer a certain side, or do they land heel to toe on one foot or toe to heel on the other? And still with the first jump, again, we're looking at maximum knee valgus angle. So we'd score an error depending on the amount of knee valgus the player presents in the landing. Scoring an error of 1 point for a small amount of knee valgus, and then if it presents a large amount of knee valgus, then the score is 2 points. And then the last thing we look at from the front and in the footage from the second jump is the amount of lateral trunk flexion the player presents on landing. You know, are they leaning to the left or right, or is there, you know, if there's any lateral flexion and other errors scored. From the side footage, third jump, it allows us to analyze the initial landing of the feet and the amount of knee flexion displacement, respectively, that the player presents during landing. So for the initial landing of feet, we look to see if the player is landing toe to heel, which is fine, or are they landing heel to toe or flat footed, which would score an error. For knee flexion displacement, we look at the amount of knee flexion that the player goes through, or knee flexion displacement the player goes through during landing. So if the amount is small, the player receives a large error of 2 points and 1 point if the amount of knee flexion is average. Also, in that third jump, we'll be looking at the amount of trunk flexion displacement presented and the points scored respectively on whether trunk flexion is small or average, which would be 2 points or 1 point respectively. During all three jumps, we're actually looking at the total joint displacement in the sagittal plane and score this as soft, which is no error, average, which would score one error point, and stiff, that would score two errors. Ideally, we want the players to obviously be landing softly and going through a large displacement of the trunk and knees. If they go through very little displacement of the trunk and knees, this is classed as a stiff landing. So the good thing is we have that video footage, so when we go back and retest, we can look at that again and compare the two, which is excellent.
Obviously, one thing that you mentioned earlier on in the podcast is you're seeing them four evenings a week for about an hour and a half, so time is very limited. Once you have done these assessments, how do you go about individualizing specific training programs in order to try to attack some of the deficiencies that you have seen in the landing error scoring test and the overhead squat test?
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting because, you know, it's not easy to individualize the training, and so the resources and contact time will determine this. But the assessments themselves give us sort of great feedback on who should be doing what and how we can improve the players in the areas that we really feel is the biggest elephant in the room. You know, that could be mobility, could be strength, it could actually be a little bit of both. That leads us to determine sort of who knows what and how we can help the players improve even when they're not with us. So the prehab or injury prevention programs, they become individualized, you know, and having had a few players who have had injury problems in the past, management is pretty vital for them. So probably more so, you know, now we're in season, which goes back to load management, which for me is probably the biggest variable in injury prevention or minimizing injury risk. But those players will do those injury prevention or prehab programs, whatever you want to call it. They will do those themselves in their own time when they're not with us.
I know it's fairly early on in the season and you just joined them in January of this year, but now that you have done these assessments during the preseason, do you have any timeline when you want to retest them to make sure that the scoring is being improved when it comes to the landing error scoring test and that the current asymmetries that they have is also being improved upon with the prehab and injury prevention programs that you're giving them?
Yeah, I mean, ideally, we'd like to do it at the end of sort of each mesocycle, but that's not really always the case. And that's just due to player contact time. You know, how much time we actually have with the players. In reality, we've got some players that may train with us a couple of times a week, but they have to, you know, travel for 2 or 3 hours and have to go to school the next day. So that, you know, so it really depends on how much time we have those players. It'll also depend on the individual as well and how much we feel they're progressing. So as a rule of thumb, the assessing would be, you know, during preseason, the end of preseason, the mid-season break and at the end of the season. And we try and get around that where we have those players with us. However, we're starting to look at some players now on a monthly basis, purely on what's opening up to us with their individual needs. As I say, this is quite a new project for us. And what they presented to us over the last couple of months of pre-season. So I also think you can observe a lot from just working with the players individually. So something might present in a session that you might not have picked up on. And I'm quite a believer, you know, as Van Gerbeta said, that training equals testing and testing equals training. So we do have times that we intend to look at them again. But again, if they're away within international squad, we might have to put it back a week or two.
Now, outside of the assessments that you mentioned earlier on, when it comes to performance testing for the players during the preseason, what type of performance testing did you do?
Yeah, so we use the yo-yo intermittent recovery one for aerobic capacity. It's quite simple to carry out. It's a pretty good indicator of VO2 max and aerobic capacity. It's not too time consuming, so we can set that up and get that done quite quickly. We've seen quite a good, consistently good improvement in scores. which agrees with his subjective opinion of squad fitness levels, you know, compared to lots of our post and pre-season. So that's pretty good. That's been quite effective for us. Repeated sprint ability. So they'll do 6 times 30 meter sprints with 30 seconds recovery. And speed, they'll do 3 times 30 meter sprints with max recovery. But again, these were carried out post-season, so at the end of last season initially, but that was to align with the national squad. So that data is then sent to us from the national squad players, and that'll allow us to compare you know, our data of our players with theirs. The national squad themselves will actually test the players regularly, and this data is always made available to us before the players return to us after being on international duty. So we can make comparisons between players that are not internationals and players that, you know, or haven't been with a national squad and players that, you know, that aren't. So that gives us some benchmarking. Alistair tends to work with a lot of the players on most of their field-based performance testing. And then the results are analysed by the two of us and discussed with the technical coaches. So at present, we're quite pleased how the players have adapted during pre-season or during the pre-season training blocks. Now the job is really to maintain the levels throughout the season, which in theory sounds great, but on an applied side and the realities of team sports, you know, being part-time, it can be a challenge, but a pretty good challenge and one we're pretty confident about.
When it comes to energy system development, you mentioned that Alistair handles a lot of the on-the-field stuff, but there's also collaboration going on. So how do you go about bucketing players or perhaps individualizing their training load to make sure that non-starters are getting enough of a stimulus throughout the week?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting one as well. Since we've only just left our pre-season, to be honest, all players have required energy system development training across the spectrum, really, aerobic, anaerobic. Ideally, the non-starters would complete energy system development training post-match, if they didn't play or during the Monday recovery sessions. But it's not always possible to carry that out immediately after a match because, limited resources, which means there might be a game straight after us. In some of the grounds that we travel to, they might have 2 or 3 games in the afternoon after us. So we can't take the players out and do that. And also on a Monday, due to player availability, some of our players might travel considerable distance to play with us in summer at school, or they might be attending the National Performance Centre at Heriot Watt University. So if that's the case, these players might complete sort of higher volumes of small-sided games, intervals on a Tuesday session to maintain a stimulus while others complete the others might go off and do what we call our sort of injury prevention neuromuscular circuits. So we'll have 7 or 8 stations set up for the other players to do. Or they might go and do some technical work while the non-starters are doing their bit. But again, this really, really depends on the availability or any injuries or maybe any players that we need to manage a little bit differently compared to the others with regard to, some previous injuries that they may have had. Myself and Alistair probably agree that it's sometimes not optimal to divide the team up into starters and non-starters. So some players, might go and play with the development team some weeks to make up match time, and it's probably better for them to play 90 minutes, and we'll have access to the data from those games as well to kind of ensure that they're not dropping below what we would require as a baseline fitness levels. The end of pre-season testing probably highlighted 2 or 3 individuals that who would probably benefit from an extra stimulus in coming weeks. We're fortunate we've got a little bit of a break now after starting the season due to internationals. So we can ensure they can contribute effectively when they're called upon as possible substitutes. And this is something we're pretty, that we're planning at the moment because we are fortunate to have that little break.
No, without a doubt. And as you mentioned, they're part-time players, but they're coming in at least sometimes a couple evenings a week. So what does your typical weekly microcycle look like in season?
Okay. We're quite lucky because we don't play midweek fixtures or we rarely play them. So that allows us to work in a typical sort of football microcycle. if such a thing exists. We're slightly
that's true.
It's a whole new ball game now, excuse the pun, but you know, we could get into that all night. So we'll look at slightly higher loading at the start of the week with a taper towards the end, typically. It also brings consistency in our training weeks, and the players know what to expect when they come training with us. It might be Lennox Town or Barrowfield, depending on where we're training. Again, David Haley's brilliant with us in as a department, allowing us to work through, you know, what needs to be done within a weekly microcycle. Once we've discussed that and said, you know, we want to do this with certain players this week. And it's great, really good to have that understanding within each of the coaching staff. You know, we all understand our jobs and crucially, we understand the style of football David wants from his players. So while David understands, you know, he also understands what we're looking to achieve as a sports science and, you know, and from the strength and conditioning side of the training. So, as I say, it's interesting that, you know, none of our players are full time, but have a massive commitment to what David and the club is working to achieve with the Celtic women's team. So a typical weekly microcycle, we would have 4 90-minute training sessions on a Monday, Tuesday, Thursday and Friday and a Sunday match day. So the players will have their resistance training programs twice a week, and they're encouraged to do their individual injury prevention programs, as we spoke about earlier. We ask them to do them 3 times a week on their own, which we make them accountable for. I think it's good to have, you know, they have that to go away with and do on their own. So Monday, that's a recovery day. So, you know, it's the day after a game. Some players may do that. You know, if they've got to travel a considerable distance, they may go and do that on their own. Most of the players will come into us. And that really just consists of sort of 20 minutes of cycling, around about 65% heart rate max, 20 minutes of stretching, 20 minutes of foam rolling, vice versa. I think it's an excellent opportunity to have all the players together. We can discuss any issues, talk to the players individually. You know, despite the subjective data that we collect, I think just asking a player how they're feeling can be really just as revealing, if not probably more revealing than a questionnaire. Some players might ask for a light technical session and that's done with the manager, with David, or his coaches, Fiona or Johnny. If the load is low, we'll allow that. But if we feel it isn't, you know, going to interfere with the player's recovery or, you know, so our player tech GPS would sort of heavily influence this decision if they want to go and do a technical session. We don't want to add any more stress to their systems. Some players might also work on their individual injury prevention program on a Monday evening. But again, it really depends on how that player's feeling and how that individual is. So we leave that up to them. On a Tuesday, we start to up it a little bit. So they'll do their ramp movement preparation warm-up, which myself or Alistair might take. And that'll be specific to the session ahead. So that will also include any sort of what we call, again, our neuromuscular circuits, you know, or exercises or injury prevention exercises. We could put those in there because we'll have that time with them. Like I say, if the time is allowed, once we've determined with David what the session he's going to do, the technical, tactical side of things and how much time we've got with them, we may make that into a circuit form. So I think I spoke earlier about 7 stations and, you know, this would kind of incorporate sort of anything from landing mechanics, change of direction, hurdle steps, jumps, and it will reflect the forthcoming session. But it's a really good opportunity to get in and coach as well practically with the players. Then we might move on to sort of high intensity intervals, small sided games. And we tend to look at that in a few ways with regard to whether we use sort of running intervals or small sided games. I think having been a player, you know, some players might see running as a punishment. And I can kind of understand that thinking. I know some coaches I had, you know, if you had a bad game, you were running for half an hour. And that was it. You know, balls didn't even come out in that first training session or second training session of the week. You know, that was your punishment, running up and down hills and whatever we used to do back in the day. But we tend to sort of mix and match that a little bit between sort of the running and the small-sided games. The small-sided games could be slightly smaller dimensions, you know, increased axles, decels, and high pressing. The volume really depends on that microcycle, and a technical tactical would take over after we've finished, which will usually be about 45 to 55 minutes for the technical tactical. Again, we predetermine this with David and his staff on how much time we're going to get with them. But David, we credit him, is pretty good when we say we might want a little bit of extra time. But players also got their resistance program to work through, which will be strength-based. And the players are in season now, so we're kind of looking to maintain the pre-season strength gains. Some of those players may do those on their own. You know, if we feel comfortable with that, they may do those on the morning on their own. Again, that's the constraints of having a, you know, very, very limited contact time. Wednesday is a day off, but the players are encouraged to do any injury prevention programs. And as I say, I kind of use the term injury prevention or prehab. It's probably not the correct term. You know, is injury preventable? You know, but we like to give them the programs, and that's based on our assessments. And then most of them will go to their own gyms. They've all got access to gyms, and one or two might come into the club to do that. And the players have been really, really good in embracing what we're doing with those. A Thursday, so we're getting nearer to the game. Again, they'll do their movement preparation warm up, and we'll also have those sort of injury prevention or neuromuscular training circuits again. So 7-8 stations. Like I said, you know, it could be changes direction, landing mechanics, hurdle steps. There's a lot of different things we can put in there for the players, and it will depend on you know what the forthcoming session or what the focus of that session is. Again, we'll have small-sided games with larger dimensions, and it kind of allows us, you know, high speed running, great distances, and the manager can really have a tactical input in that if he feels it's needed. The players again have their resistance programs, which they'll work through on a Thursday as well. Again, some will come into us for that. There may be one or two of the slightly more experienced players that will do those on a Thursday morning before they go off to work or university, before they come into us in the evening. And then the technical tactical side will follow that with David and his coaching staff. A Friday is our match preparation session. So again, you know, we've got our movement prep warm up followed by sort of activation work and our, you know, again, going back to those neuromuscular, you know, injury prevention circuits. We might be able to get those in. We all could also move into sort of a high speed running drill there, 4 or 5 reps. It's often in a competitive race format, you know, because that ensures, you know, real maximal effort and a bit of competitiveness between the players, which I think is a really good thing. You know, it goes back to building a culture with the players. We encourage them to be competitive. I don't see there's anything wrong with that. We have quite high rest there and low reps to sort of minimize fatigue, you know, because we're aware we're 2 days away from a game. We're pretty fortunate in respect that, you know, that our games are on a Sunday afternoon. So although we planned that taper towards the end of the weekly microcycle, we are on the side of caution with the players, and that they will have a complete day of rest on the day before a game. When we finished our work, the technical tactical side is really the majority of the session, being so close to the game. That could be anything from set pieces, defensive drills, or, you know, whatever the technical team decide that they need to work on in preparation for the forthcoming game. And then, as I said, Saturday they're off, so the players are resting and you know, and getting prepared themselves in their own ways for the game on a Sunday. And then we've got Sunday, which is match day, you know, the day we've sort of all prepared for. And on a match day, we really like to keep things simple, but, you know, we have an emphasis on getting all the little things in place, but we, you know, that we feel will make a big difference. So one of the little things we've introduced is having a running order for match days. So every player, every member of staff, you know, from the warm up to going in with the coaches to what we do with those players, we all know exactly what time we should be doing. You know, even from the captain leading some light running drills before they come in with us, everybody knows what time they're doing that and where they need to be at a certain time.
One key theme that I've heard time and time again within this podcast is making small changes in order to have a big impact. And right at the beginning of the podcast, you mentioned nutrition and recovery, that those were two things that you really focused on as a staff. You mentioned a little bit about nutrition, but now on the recovery side, how did you talk to the players about the importance of sleep quality and what type of recovery modalities do you use with the players?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, we've used quite a few with the players, but this mainly comes from the presentations we make and also the weekly email that I said that we send out to the players, you know. So we're able to get across examples. So one of the recommendations we made with our players is to use the Sleep Cycle app. So they can monitor their sleep. And within that email, we sent links to the app and said, you know, the reason sleep is important. We'll go into as much detail as we can without being overly scientific, because there's no need for us to completely overload them with the scientific jargon. And within those emails, one of the ones we focused on is, you know, the importance of recovery and supercompensation theory as such, and why that, how we can, how that can influence their recovery and how it can improve them, how their performance can improve. So it is very much an ongoing process educationally, and we get that across through our emails and our presentations. So some of the protocols we've introduced would be your pretty much standard, you know, they have their protein or recovery shakes straight after a game. We've sent them documents saying, you know, we want you to eat as soon as possible. So they'll have their recovery shake within, let's say, 20 minutes. Then we'll get them to eat within an hour, 2 hours. Again, that's an ongoing project. It's quite a big one. So we've made those small little changes just with the pre-match, the intra-match, the post-match, and gradually we're getting down into the nitty-gritty details and making those small little changes as we go along.
The way I typically like to end my podcast is giving recommendations to young strength and conditioning coaches, but you come from a fairly unique background in that you're a player yourself, you ran an academy, you were a technical coach. How did those things influence your career as a sports scientist?
Yeah, I think it did, to be honest. I don't think I was ever cut out to be a technical coach, to be honest. I think it influenced me massively because I've been on the other side of it. And probably not, you know, a lot of the time I didn't understand it as a player. And I was like, you know, what's this bloke going on about, or what are they trying to tell me? So I think that's kind of influenced me in the education side of things. So giving that transparency to the players, giving them accountability so they understand what I'm trying to get across or what Alistair's trying to get across, but they have a knowledge of it. I think it's really important with players that you learn to communicate at all different levels. But, you know, I'm not sure that most players really want to know the biomechanical, jargon from a squat. But they will want to know that it's going to make them a little bit stronger and possibly a little bit quicker. So I think it's, you know, working on a technical side, going over to sports scientists, you can form a philosophy of, you know, constantly educating these players into what you're doing. So the S&C coach or the sports scientist is not seen as, you know, that geeky guy sitting behind a laptop all the time, getting loads of data in and then just making statements which none of them understand anyway. So I think it's about being a realist and communicating with the players the way probably I would have expected maybe, you know, 20 years ago. I'm showing my age here, but when I was playing and this kind of stuff was coming to the forefront, which, let's be honest, when I was playing, none of us knew what it was about. You know, for young coaches, I think probably the biggest bit of advice I was ever given was, you know, to believe in yourself. I think elite sport is a tough industry to crack. I think if you're prepared to work hard and have a hunger to keep learning, then really anything's possible. Football is quite a small industry, and everyone tends to know everyone. And I think that's vital. You know, do a good job, get yourself known, but be prepared to work hard. You know, a lot of top level S&C coaches I've come across have spoken about young coaches having a passion and desire to make it in the industry, and especially in football. I don't think you ever stop learning. And I think having knowledge is one thing, but actually applying it is another. And I suppose that's where I've been fortunate from the technical side to what I do now. You know, I've had the best of both worlds. You know, there's a lot of clubs out there who are not full-time and who would love to work you know, with a young coach's knowledge and in an area they might not have any experience in. You know, go back to this season, start of this season, working with Welling Garden City was a fantastic experience. And I really hope the players learn something. Obviously, I wasn't doing my job. But it also give a young coach a chance to find themselves being in that environment. You haven't got the luxuries of maybe full-time football and everything that goes with it. So you learn really quickly. You learn on the job. And I think in life, be it football, sports, sports science, strength and conditioning, you know, whether you work in a shop to some extent, you only ever learn by doing something. I think getting on technical coaching courses like, you know, the FA, the Scottish FA ones, you know, they're a good way to learn as well. I mean, coaching is an art form, really. It takes years of refinement to master. I don't think you don't become an excellent coach overnight. You really have to develop those skills. I think it's a good thing, but, you know, you never stop learning. So getting on a technical course, and that doesn't matter if that's the, you know, the FA level one, I think you will learn a lot about that, you know, how to set up sessions. You know, there's no point walking into a session setting out cones when a player is, you know, or a squad is already out there. So I think it's vital that, you know, at some point you also sit down and think about what your coaching philosophy is. You know, it's very important to have that philosophy. It'll help you with decision-making in your career. Who you want to work with, you know, where you want to work, and these things are important because they do define your career as a coach. Read as much as possible, you know, stay up to date with the latest research. The likes of Twitter can be really invaluable. You know, the Historic Performance podcasts, Rob Pace's, well, they're excellent sources of information with some real, you know, top dollar coaches on there who are, you know, pretty open with their information. And I think that's a good thing. I think there has to be that transparency. You know, most coaches are really willing to share as much information as possible. And I think one of the biggest lessons I probably learned quite early in myself was that, you know, often the theory of things is different to the applied setting. And that's really where you need to get your experience in an applied setting. You know, have the willingness to learn and, you know, what you can on a job, get to know people. You know, ask questions. You know, the answers are always in the questions. You know, there's no such thing as a bad question. And, you know, as we keep reminding all of our players, you know, it's the little things that make a big, big difference.
Andrew, if anyone has any questions or comments regarding the podcast, what's the best way that they can contact you?
Yeah, probably the best way is Twitter, really, which is at Mr. Wisey Man. You can get me on there. You know, happy to answer any questions about the podcast or anything else that anybody would like to ask about yet. But that's probably the best way.
Sounds good. I'll make sure to include your Twitter handle in the show notes.
No problem.
Andrew, pleasure having you on the podcast today. Thanks so much for coming on.
No problem. It's been my absolute pleasure and best of luck.
Hey guys, thanks again for tuning in to another episode of the Historic Performance Podcast. If you enjoyed it, please make sure to head over to iTunes and leave a review and rating. It really helps others discover the show. Outside of the podcast, tomorrow there's going to be a guest post by Paul Morgan, and he is with Exeter City. And he's going to be talking about their recovery protocols and some of the challenges that they face in non-league football. On Thursday, as I mentioned, Michael's going to be coming on. He is the head of performance at Sri Lanka Cricket, and he's going to be talking about some of the work that he's doing there in order to make sure that Sri Lanka remains a world power in cricket. So I'll see you guys on Thursday.